Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A sound and sophisticated understanding of the risks of material misstatement and planning and executing the audit in a way that responds to those risks are essential to affording investors reasonable assurance that financial statements are free of material error. The board's mandate is to ensure quality auditing and to promote confidence in audit reports. Therefore, focusing on the risk assessment process and the auditor's response to risk is one of the most important steps we can take to strengthen the auditing standards. This effort is especially timely given current events in our financial markets. I support publishing these 7 proposed standards for comment. Reliably identifying risk is not a simple task or one that lends itself to predetermined formulas and checklists. Rather than adding to what's already been said about the specific approach to that process that's in these proposals, I'd like to underscore several points about this project itself. First, it seems to me that this proceeding marks something of a new direction in our standard setting. So far, most of the energy the board has devoted to writing auditing standards has been aimed at fulfilling specific statutory tasks in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, particularly developing an internal control auditing standard and a standard for concurring partner review. Risk assessment is the first major effort to do what I think Congress envisioned when it gave the board the authority to set public company auditing standards. Step back and ask how the existing standards can be strengthened to meet the challenges of modern auditing. Second, as has been noted, the staff began formulating the risk assessment standards by looking at the comparable provisions of the international auditing standards, the ICES. The board is still feeling its way in trying to determine what the relationship between PCAOB standards and the ICES should be. At least for now, an approach that tries to avoid needless inconsistency, but that stops short of seeking conformity for its own sake, seems to me to make sense. I think these proposals have benefited from the effort that went into looking first at the ICES. However, the resulting package of standards is by no means a twin to the ICES. Cousins, or perhaps distant cousins, might better describe the family relationship. The release includes an appendix that provides a high-level comparison between these proposals and the comparable ICES. The merits of the approach taken here is one of the areas in which I hope we'll receive thoughtful comment. Third, unlike other board standards, each of these proposals includes a brief statement of the audit objective that the standard is intended to fulfill. Here, too, the board needs the views and suggestions of commenters to make sure the objectives are phrased in a way that will be useful in guiding auditors, particularly in areas that demand judgment. The final point I'd like to make relates to the transparency and openness of the board's standard-setting process. This project began about 3 years ago with a public discussion of audit risk assessment by the board's standing advisory group, and ideas from that meeting are reflected in the proposals. The staff is recommending a 120-day comment period, longer than what's been our norm in the past, to afford ample opportunity for public input. Depending upon the nature of the comment, I hope we'll consider additional steps to promote transparency. Possibilities could include publishing a revised proposal and opening a second comment period, depending upon the comment we get, or based on the comment we get in this first round. We may also want to hold additional public forums or board discussions to consider the comments. For a project of the magnitude and importance of risk assessment, we need to make sure that investors in the profession understand what we're seeking to accomplish and that we understand the practical consequences of any new standards. A tremendous amount of thought and effort has already gone into this project, and I'd like to join in thanking the staff members involved. I won't try and name everyone. I know that's been done already, but I'll just mention Keith Wilson particularly, who's, I think, pretty much lived and breathed this project for the last 2 or 3 months. Certainly takes nothing away from that work to add that, more than in the case of some other proposed standards, I view the risk assessment project as one that's still unfolding. I look forward to input and dialogue that will help the board make sure that these standards are well-tailored the sophisticated audit risk assessment and high-quality auditing. With that, there were just a couple of things I wanted to ask about. I mean, there's so much here that would be interesting to talk about. I'm sure we could go on all day, but maybe just a couple of things. There's been some mention of the objectives already. Each of the standards includes an objective. In general, they're in the form of a declaratory statement. For example, the proposed standard on audit risk and an audit of financial statements says, the objective of the auditor is to conduct the audit of the financial statements in a manner that reduces risk to an appropriately low level. Niemeyer's comments, I think, flag the fact that that isn't stated, at least directly stated, as a requirement. I wonder, Keith or Jennifer, if you can comment on whether that is a requirement. Can the objective be violated if it is a requirement? So what level of a requirement? Is it a must requirement or a should requirement?
I'd be happy to answer that question. The way we've structured the objectives is they are not to impose a requirement necessarily. We do not, as you read the phrase, there was no language from our rule, Board's Rule 3101, so there was no must statement or should statement or other statements like that that would impose a direct obligation. With that said, however, there are other requirements in each of the standards that do use terms as defined under Board's Rule 3101 with must and should. So we believe that if the auditor follows, adheres to those requirements, they would in effect meet the obligation, but stated in and of itself, the objective does not impose a specific obligation. We are certainly interested in comments and feedback on this point, whether we should use such language in the Board's Rule 3101, such as must and should, in articulating those objectives, but currently right now that's how the objectives are phrased.
Okay. There's an exception, though, isn't there?
There is one.
The standard on audit planning and supervision includes a second sentence. Accordingly, the auditor must adequately plan the audit and properly supervise the members of the engagement team. I mean, that is a must requirement. I mean, what's the thinking of having what I take it is, well, maybe I should ask you the question, is that an enforceable requirement? Does it contain the word must? And if so, why is that one different?
Well, in that particular case, what we were trying to do, it's not necessarily part of the objective, although it certainly is in line with the objective, and we would expect that must statement to be an unconditional responsibility that would be enforceable, that is in line with the overall objective. And that's generally the way we tried to approach it, was to construct requirements that would lead the auditor toward fulfilling that objective, and that was one case where we felt like that was an important statement to make in that particular standard. And I will add that we feel very consistent with the requirement for planning and supervision, for example, in AU-150.
Okay. Well, I mentioned it because I think several of us have noted this idea of objectives is somewhat new for us. I think it can be a useful tool in helping the auditor understand what the standard is supposed to accomplish and therefore affording guidance in all the judgment areas that are inherent in the process. And I hope people will comment about whether these are the correct objectives or whether they can be strengthened or made clearer. Let me ask you about something else. Keith, in your comments, I think you talked about the relationship to AU 316, the existing fraud standard, and at least to me, one of the themes here is to take the kind of process that AU 316 describes in identifying the risks of fraud at the beginning of the audit and expanding that or spreading it to a more general consideration of the risks of material misstatement. What's left of AU 316? Why do we need an AU 316? I take it that while you make some amendments to the fraud standard, the fraud standard will remain. What's the relationship between that and the new standards? Why do we need both?
Well, what the elements of the existing fraud standard that we brought into the risk assessment standard are the are the specific principles related to identifying fraud risk and assessing fraud risk and designing procedures that are generally responsive to fraud risk and evaluating results. What is left in there is still, I think, very important information. There is a general discussion about the auditor's responsibilities with respect to fraud that remains in that part of the standard. And there's also more specific procedural requirements and direction related to specific elements such as journal entry testing and other kinds of specific procedures that would be part of the auditor's response to fraud risks. We think it's important to continue to have that because, frankly, fraud is such an important consideration. But at the same time, we want the reason for folding those requirements into the risk assessment standards was to try and make that the consideration of fraud a central part of the overall risk assessment process.
Okay, let me turn to a different one. There's, again, as I think you mentioned in your comments, there's a proposed standard on consideration of materiality as there is in the existing auditing standards. Maybe the first question is, would that proposed standard change or interpret the definition of materiality?
No, the standard begins with the concept of materiality in the federal securities laws. It does not seek to interpret or modify that in any way. What it does is try and help provide information for the auditor to understand how to take that concept and apply it in terms of determining the scope of audit procedures.
I just wanted to bring that question. Presumably, that's obvious to most auditors, at least. But we're not the deciders on materiality. So,
right.
People aren't happy with materiality. Please address your comments. That's actually not us. Along those lines, there's a statement in that standard that says that the auditor should evaluate uncorrected misstatements based on qualitative and quantitative factors. And again, perhaps not a surprising statement or not a change. I was kind of struck that the SEC's recent advisory committee on complexity and financial reporting devoted some discussion to the relationship between quantitative and qualitative factors in evaluating the materiality of misstatements. Would our proposed standard be compatible with what CIFR has said or the way in which the SEC might implement CIFR? I mean, was any thought given to the CIFR report in drafting that portion of that standard?
Well, I guess in light of, I would say, similar to what I just said, we're not trying to provide any specific guidance about materiality and to interpret the concept of materiality as it exists in the federal securities law. So we recognize that materiality considerations, as set up in the federal securities laws, does recognize the consideration of both quantitative and qualitative factors. So we have a requirement for the auditor to consider those, but we don't get into the particulars of how they might look at those factors and weight one versus the other.
Yeah, again, I guess from my perspective, it's an effort to make sort of the same point. The question of the role of qualitative factors in evaluating materiality is one that's been much discussed, at least since SAB 99 came out and maybe before then. And again, it's not really our jurisdiction to modify or change those principles. Maybe sticking with materiality, but I'll ask about it in a little different context. Again, as I think you noted in your comments, there's an appendix at the end of the release that people will discover entitled Additional Discussion of Proposed Auditing Standards and Conforming Amendments. And that's it's really an analysis or description of each of the proposed standards. What's the authority level of that material? Does that impose requirements? Is it enforceable? Does it have requirements in it beyond the text of the standards themselves?
I can take that one. The appendices that you refer to are not intended to impose requirements. Rather than being provided for illustrative purposes, to help, as Keith said, to help explain the standards and our thinking behind the proposed standards. And that level of authority, or not having, not imposing a requirement, we would expect would continue when the board were to adopt the final standards. So if we were to have similar language, that it would not be intended to impose a requirement. The standards themselves would impose the requirement, and that would just be there for illustrative explanatory information.
So, for example, in the appendix, in its discussion materiality, the appendix talks about the fact, again, not a new concept, that the judgment of a reasonable investor might be influenced by a misstatement at a smaller level of materiality than for the financial statements generally with respect to some particular account. And then it contains some examples of where that this kind of lower level of materiality might be appropriate. What's the significance of the fact that those examples are in Appendix 9 rather than in the standards themselves? Because the standards do have, at least in notes, some things that could be viewed as examples.
Yeah, this was placed in there just to try and help some provide a little bit more context to the particular point about considering instances in where in which a lower level of materiality might be warranted, because misstatements might affect the judgment of a reasonable investor. So the intent was just to provide some situations where that might be the case, but not necessarily propose any kind of additional requirement, because it's a concept, as you mentioned, that is outside our jurisdiction. And in some other cases we have provided examples, but they tend to be more procedural in nature, to help someone understand what a particular audit procedure is intended to accomplish.
I think you didn't touch on in your comments is the interplay between these standards and auditing standard number 3, the documentation requirement. I'm going to guess, obviously, under general concepts of AS3, what is done as part of the risk assessment process and the steps taken in the audit will have to be reflected in the work papers. Are there any more specific documentation requirements in these standards? I guess what I'm thinking, for example, is, will our inspection staff or perhaps the concurring partner, the engagement quality reviewer, be able to find a statement in the work papers as to the assessed risks that the audit team identified as part of the planning of the audit? Will that be in one place in the work papers, or simply the steps and work be spread out through the work papers? Do we give any guidance on that subject in these standards?
Well, we looked at that, and this is an area that we're very interested in getting comment on. We looked at that and looked at the requirements of AS3 regarding documentation, and noted that AS3 requires the auditor to document procedures performed, evidence obtained, and conclusions reached with respect to relevant assertions. It requires the auditor to document compliance with the requirements of the standards of the PCAOB, and it was our view that was going to act, the requirements of AS3 as written would be adequate to cover the documentation for the requirements of the standard. Now, to your specific question about a summary of risks, I think if you look at the process that's laid out in the standards, and you look at the fact that the auditor is going to need to have adequate responses to those risks, it would be, in my mind, very difficult, virtually impossible, to do that without somehow coming down with a summary of the risks and the what the risks were, what the assessment of the risks were, and what the linkage is between the audit procedures and those risks. So I think it's inherent in the way AS3 would lead the auditor to look at these standards. However, we did tee that up quite a bit in the appendix that I mentioned earlier at the back of the release. We listed some specific examples of things that we thought AS3 would require the auditor to do with respect to the document compliance with these standards. and ask for specific feedback on whether or not we needed to provide individual specific documentation requirements and standards. So we're very much eager to get feedback on that point.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's really the reason I asked the question, because I think that is an area where it would be useful to get comment, and maybe comment in part. I think we need to give some thought to whether we should have a more, I guess, a more concentrated, a more focused requirement to document the, sort of an overview of the risk assessment in a single place in the work papers. And again, I think particularly about the obligations we're proposing to impose on engagement quality reviewers to identify the risks in the audit. It might be useful to them if they could look in a single place to get the engagement team thinking. Well, look, I'll finish with just one extremely general question, and I'm sure we'll hear about this in comments too, but I would be interested in your view. From particularly from the viewpoint of the largest firms in the country, to what extent do you see these proposals in the form they're in today as changing the way that they conduct risk assessment, and what, as a corollary, what impact do you see them having on the cost of auditing?
Well, I would say, first of all, the proposed standards here, I would not say was any attempt to reinvent the wheel. We're not trying to create out of whole cloth a new process, but what we are trying to do is take into account improvements that have been made, particularly by the large firms, in their process for assessing and responding to risk, and also to help hopefully create some improvements in that process. So I don't know that we would find that there will be a lot of new requirements or the formulations used in the standards would generate a significant amount of increased audit effort. But that's another area that we're very interested in seeking comment on. What are the expectations when auditors look at that? Do they maybe have a different perspective? And what's the perspective of others as well on the value of the procedures as laid out and the perceived level of effort that's associated with that? So we have a lot of questions in that appendix in the release that are around those kind of areas of the expected impact on auditor performance.
Well, again, I appreciate that. I think it's important that we get those comments. That we've been at this now for what, 6 years, and I think sometimes we find that people have a different view of what the impact on auditing and the cost of auditing is going to be of our proposals than we have, and it is important that we get that information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, one more comment?
Yeah, yes. I apologize, but Mr. Gelder had a question, and just if I could just have a point of clarity. When we talk about appendices and that they're illustrative only, to the extent the language within the appendix is actually saying that the auditor should do something. It was meant that the auditor should do it, right?
Well, for the most part, I'm trying to search my memory here, but for the most part, I think when we've said auditors should do something, we're trying to be reflective of what the requirements are in the standard. So to that extent, I definitely think that's the case. If there's a point where in which we said should that wasn't somehow derived from the standard, then that would be, I guess, something we'd have to look at. But.
Thank you. It probably is something that, as this process goes along, we need to focus on. Because one of our comments about the ICES has been that the authority level of their application material isn't clear, and we don't want to back into the same problem.
Right. We've spent some time focusing earlier on determining what should mean,
mm-hmm.
and so I just want to make sure we don't confuse that by saying that because it's in the appendix that it doesn't mean what we intend for it to say.
And let me just make a. Since you brought that up, let me clarify one thing, because we talked about a lot of appendices here. There are appendices to the standards themselves. A couple of these standards actually have appendices, and those appendices are part of the standard. So they would definitely create an auditor responsibility.
Sure.
The appendices we've been usually talking about have been the explanatory appendices right at the very end of the release, but certainly the ones in the appendices to the standards definitely have requirements.
Thank you. Okay. There's no further discussion. I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes have it, and the motion is carried. Board member Steve Harris, who had an unavoidable conflict and could not be here today, asked that I indicate his support for these standards and for moving the standards forward. There being no further business, the meeting is adjourned. We will now rise from the open meeting and reconvene at 10:30 in the closed meeting. Thank you very much.